And that's also about the
All right.
What was that?
Do I try it again? We gotta warm up. Just wanted to get your attention. It worked.
It's all in the wrist.
We are calling the meeting to order, and note that there is a quorum present. Members, Chair Liebling is in Philadelphia this week welcoming a new grandchild, so we will wish her all the best. And she has entrusted the gavel to me for today, so help me out. First order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Smith, would you care to move the minutes of March 19th, please?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the meeting minutes from March 19th.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. We have another set of minutes, March 20th, please, Representative Smith.
Yep, look this one over as well. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move approval of the minutes for March 20th.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Motion prevails, and the minutes from March 20th are adopted. All right, we have a number of bills today. We're going until 12 o'clock. We will try to move it along, get through all of them. First House file up is by House File 3889, Representative Hicks. Is she present? I don't see her, so we will move to the next one and circle back. We will go to House File 3339, Representative Cagle, please. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cagle, and I will move House File 3339, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. There is an author's amendment, so the chair will move the A3 to put the bill in the form the author intends for discussion. All in favor of adoption of the A3?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. So the bill is amended as you would like, Rep. Cagle. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill is obviously somewhat personal to me. Being somebody who has suffered limb loss, it's often a surprise and a little bit traumatic. And so, you know, I was lucky that this happened to me late in life. And so I had, you know, 40 years with all 10 fingers. But some people, you know, don't have that and lose a limb at an early age. And I think back to my days in elementary school, middle school, even high school, how many sports I played and how if I didn't have my fingers on my left hand, how I could control a baseball glove or, you know, if I had lost a leg and how would I run to the bases, you know? And so some of these things are lifelong activities that we want people to do. And when you don't have the proper equipment, it's really limiting. And so this is just making sure that folks who have suffered limb loss get the proper equipment to live active lives that they want to live. And with that, I will turn it over to my... Oh, one other thing. These things are super expensive. Each one of these fingers runs between $5,000 and $20,000. And because it took so long for them to even get my... It was a year and a half that it took to get this thing approved. By the time I had gotten it approved and started working with getting this prosthetic, I had already gotten used to not using, you know, not having fingers on my left hand. And so now you think about any time I grab a grocery bag, it's putting all that pressure down there. And, you know, people get bunions. I'm probably going to have a hand bunion someday and bad arthritis. And so just thinking about how if I was able to use this and was more used to it, how it would really support my hand and my fingers. And now I just feel like it's kind of just in the way. And so I'm really getting it early and making sure that we are able to use them properly is a really big deal. So with that, I will hand it over to my testifier.
Thank you. And the testifier would introduce yourself to the committee, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bierman and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today in support of House File 3339. My name is Elsa Keeler. I live with limb loss. In January of 2019, I was diagnosed with a rare, aggressive, metastatic bone cancer. My right leg was amputated above the knee, and I underwent treatment for 2.5 years. I am so grateful to be alive and healthy today. From the very beginning of this journey, I worked with a prosthetic professional and my doctor to access a prosthetic limb that would suit my medical needs as an active adult. The process was lengthy, with many pages of documentation, prior authorization, and utilization review required. My employer-based health plan approved a microprocessor knee, and when my health returned, I embraced the outdoor activities that I loved: hiking, kayaking, cross-country skiing, and paddling and portaging on canoe trips with my family. In 2023, my prosthetic limb stopped functioning and was beyond repair. By this time, I had retired and was under my husband's health plan. I was prescribed a much-needed waterproof prosthetic that would allow me to safely shower and bathe on two limbs instead of hopping on one, walk into the water to swim, actually run across the yard with my grandson Theo, and continue my active life. The claim was denied. It did not meet the health plan's definition of, quote, a standard model that met minimum specifications, end quote, for my needs. I found myself wondering if I'm worthy. I should also mention that I'm a retired pediatric physician. I have spent my career advocating for children's health issues. I am keenly aware of the complicated nature of healthcare coverage and how hard it is to accomplish needed change. However, the time for this change is now. This bill would assure that people with limb loss have access through their health insurance to the appropriate medically necessary prosthetics needed to run, walk, bike, swim, play sports, and improve their health. Active movement for people with limb loss is not a privilege, it is a necessity. We have overwhelming medical data on the benefits of physical activity in the prevention and management of so many diseases and ultimately life expectancy. This is very much an equity issue. Everyday elective knee repairs and joint replacements occur for the purpose of returning someone to active life. The orthopedic surgeon decides on the most effective internal prosthesis for this procedure. This is standard of care, routinely covered by health plans. But when a child or active adult with limb loss needs an external prosthesis for the same activity, they are denied coverage. This bill assures that health plans will cover prosthetic care for disabled and non-disabled people equally and no longer discriminate against those who need external prostheses in order to have active movement. The fiscal impact of this bill supports overall savings through improved patient health and lower healthcare costs. Safeguards are in place to assure proper utilization review and prevention of fraud. Medicare sets the standard for coverage of prosthetic devices, known as K levels, to determine which device would be most medically appropriate. An individual, like myself, is assessed an activity level from K0 to K4. Activity-specific blades and devices are prescribed only for those who meet the higher activity levels, including children, active adults, or athletes who have potential for running, climbing, steep hills, or high-impact movement. As a pediatrician, I used to tell my young patients that their job is to run, jump, and play every day. Physical activity is one of the most powerful behaviors to assure a healthy body and a healthy mind. Children move spontaneously. They accelerate from 0 to 90 in seconds. For a healthy child with limb loss, their ability to run is not limited by the lack of a limb. They are limited only by the lack of access to the prosthetic device designed for running. Having a running blade to move should no longer be a privilege that is cost prohibitive for most families in Minnesota. Medically appropriate prosthetics for active mobility, safe showering, and bathing are necessary, safe, effective, and it's time for them to be covered by our health plans. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Keeler. And there is another testifier, Mr. Ellis.
Please.
please pull that microphone down and introduce yourself with your name, please, for the committee?
Hi, everyone. My name is Walker Ellis. I am 9 years old, and I live in Woodbury, Minnesota. I'm in third grade at Red Rock Elementary School. 1 year ago, I received my running blade from a nonprofit organization called Wiggle Your Toes. Before, I only had a regular running blade, everyday blade that didn't offer much feedback. Since receiving the running blade, I have so much more confidence to be able to play sports that I love. Now I can keep up with my friends when we play soccer, flag football, ride my bike, jump on the trampoline, or even just playing tag. With my running blade, there are no limits for me. However, I still need an everyday blade to get around the house when I am at the beach and when I am in snow. But still, I use my running blade leg every day too. Both are necessary for me to be the kid that I want to be. So please support this bill so I can continue gaining confidence with two legs that are needed to accomplish my goals. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Walker Ellis, thank you for being here today. Really appreciate your testimony. Very valuable for the committee. Thank you so much, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.
All right, I have, those are the only two testifiers I have on my list. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions and discussion. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, line 6.1, I believe, applies this to our public programs. And so I'm wondering, you know, I think we have heard that it already applies to CGIP. Does it already apply to public programs, or will this be a new benefit under our public programs?
Representative Cagle.
I thought it was, but I would like to actually defer to staff just to check.
Okay. Mr. Chen?
Mr. Chair and members, there is a current benefit for prosthetics and orthotics that's on Section 3 of the bill. And what the bill does is it kind of strikes the coverage language there, and it adds Sections 4 and 5, which provides more detailed language of the coverage that it would apply.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps, Mr. Chung, can you help us understand what the changes will be to the current coverage versus new coverage under this language?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, I talked briefly with DHS about this, and they said that most of the new requirements are already something that MA does. For example, they you know, pretty much follows, for example, the Medicare coverage guidelines. They did mention that lines 6.17 to 6.20, this would be sort of a new provision for medical assistance. And I think maybe if you have more detailed questions, you know, perhaps they could speak, you know, further to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. And the bill will be laid over if we want to dig into it deeper. Another question, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this have a fiscal note yet?
Yes.
Mr. Harney, comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, the fiscal note request is currently active. DHS has not completed the fiscal note yet.
Thank you, Mr. Harney. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it seems that this will then expand the scope of what's currently done in the programs, in our public programs. So this will be an increased benefit that will have a cost to the state. So it's important for us to understand what that is before moving forward. And again, I would just say again, in fact, Walker, it was so fun to listen to you testify. My brother was a triple amputee, and he didn't have either of his legs. And so we grew up with lots of legs. And let me tell you, you're going to have a lot of fun with old legs that you've outgrown and the fun tricks you can play on people with those. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Can you explain to me on 5.25 to 5.27 we pulled out the definition in 256B of what a licensed practitioner is. Can you tell me why we did that? And under your bill, under 5.24, what a licensed practitioner is? This a, could it be a behavioral analyst? Who can prescribe now?
What line?
Representative Cagle.
Sorry. What line again? I'm sorry.
5.25.
5.25.
5.27.
I'm not. I think I'm not sure on that one. Actually, maybe I have to put my testifier.
Dr. Keeler.
Chair Bierman, I can't comment on the bill, but I can comment on the utilization review that all health plans have in place, and that is criteria for fitting for prescribing of these prosthetics. They have to be, and I have that, fitted by a prosthetist experience in fitting the specific prosthetic devices.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not interested in fitting the prosthetic. I'm interested in prescribing. So maybe, does anybody know?
Dr. Keeler? And we have some help coming forward.
Actually,
please introduce yourself for the committee.
Hi, my name is Terry Cuffell. I am from Spring Lake Park, Minnesota, and I work in the orthotic and prosthetic field. Representative Nadeau, the prescribers for orthotic and prosthetic care really are regulated by Medicare guidelines. We have O&P licensure in the state of Minnesota, so the professionals who are fitting the devices are licensed here. Those who prescribe the devices are on par with those that are dictated by Medicare. That would be physicians, physician assistants, specifically Giogo is here as well. We've had an amendment a few years ago with regard to the state plans and the prescribers who could prescribe for orthotic and prosthetic care. And those prescribers follow Medicare guidelines.
Thank you, Ms. Couple.
Representative Nadeau. And thank you for that, and I trust that. But I'm just wondering if we're expanding, if this language expands it so that a pharmacist could prescribe a limb, for example.
That is not the way it works in Minnesota. So we do follow, again, Medicare guidelines. That's the way the system is set up. Also with the medical criteria and the documentation required of the orthotic and prosthetic facilities to bill for claims, we're required to work off an order. We liken ourselves to a custom goods pharmacy. So we have to have a prescription from a physician come through our door in order for us to deliver the prosthetic device or orthotic device.
Thank you, Ms. Koppel.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly my question. Who you're going to get that prescription from a licensed practitioner, and what we're doing in what this language is being stricken. So it's basically saying that it used to be that a physician, an advanced practicing registered nurse, a physician assistant, or a podiatrist could prescribe that, and we're getting rid of that, and it's now just a licensed practitioner. So can a psychologist, can a behavioral analyst, I mean, I'm just wondering if we should have that, and I recognize that there's a process that we go through with Medicare, and I trust that. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why we're removing this language in 256B.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Representative Cagle.
Thank you. I just want to kind of go back to then, if we go to page 6, 6.6, that I think that kind of in section 1, it says furnished under order by a prescribing physician or licensed healthcare prescriber who has authority in Minnesota to prescribe orthesis and prosthetics. So maybe staff can tell us what statute that's referring to and what the definition of that is there, I guess.
Thank you, Representative Cagle.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Nadeau, I mean, that is correct. The original language, you know, referred to physicians, APRNs, and physician assistants and podiatrists, and that was including. And that language is replaced by the language on 6.12, which refers to the physician or a licensed healthcare prescriber.
Thank you.
So it's sort of different phrasing of the language allowing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chun.
And thank you for that. And can I just follow up then?
Please,
you added
Representative Nadeau.
A licensed health care prescriber. I don't think I've seen that in statute. I haven't seen them all, but is there a definition to licensed health care prescriber then? Would that include a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a pharmacist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nadeau, I think it depends on the specific service. Because, you know, there's a scope of practice and people can prescribe, certain people prescribe prescription drugs. So the licensed prescribers use in the pharmacy statutes. In this case, it would be prescribing, you know, medical equipment. So I think whoever has the scope of practice authority prescribed, that would be the reference to those individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chun. Representative Nadeau, is this helpful?
Oh,
and we can take
you,
it offline too.
Yeah, thank you. I'll follow up with the author just to make sure that I fully understand this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of perusing through that myself, and I think on lines 1.20, 2.23, and 2.28, it also does point out healthcare provider licensed in Minnesota operating within the scope of practice. So just wanting to say that my interpretation is that it's listed elsewhere throughout the statute and just kind of echoing what Mr. Chun said. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it would be a good practice if, when we're asking for a definition and statute, that we be given the statute that the staff is referencing. And I believe that specifically listing, like it was, gives a safer level of confidence than going to an ambiguous phrase and guessing that there would be a scope somewhere or definition somewhere. So I'm a bit disappointed, until we get clarification, I think we really need to, not have this go forward until everyone on the committee actually gets specific clarification, because we don't want to make a mistake and cause issues that open the door to problems. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. We will have some time to do that. We will proceed to lay the bill over today, but we'll have time to review that language and answer member questions. Representative Cagle, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that this is something that we need to make sure that people can live the lives that they want to, be active, play sports, and just be a kid. When we had this hearing in Commerce, one of the testifiers had her leg amputated when she was 10 and wasn't able to swim. Being a kid in Minnesota in the summer, can you imagine not being able to jump into a lake when it's hot? And so those are just some of the things that, you know, we want to make sure that kids have the active lifestyle, that they're taking care of themselves, and that we're getting the equipment we need in a timely manner so it doesn't affect our health. So I appreciate the hearing and hope for its inclusion in the final bill.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. And House File 3339, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. So now we will go back to House File 3889, Representative Hicks. And the chair will move that House File 3889, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Hicks, welcome to the committee, and please proceed when you are ready.
Thank you so much, and I do appreciate my tardiness. It is a busy time of session, so thank you for accommodating me. House File 3889 seeks to ensure that amino acid-based formula is covered by commercial providers and ensures that individuals with complex medical needs that require this formula to stay on the planet are able to access access it regardless of payer source. I don't have any testifiers with me today because of the snowstorm, but I will stand in for my daughter. Ellie, who many of you have met, was born completely healthy and ready to take on the world. Starting at about, actually very early, just a few weeks after birth, she started to really have eczema and strange gastroparesis sort of symptoms and all kinds of medical issues, and we were in and out of the doctors. Nobody was really sure what was going on, but we knew it was complex and couldn't quite figure out what was happening. I was exclusively nursing Eleonora at the time, and the reactions kept happening. So the solution was to change my diet, eat less of, don't eat dairy, don't eat gluten, don't eat rice, maybe try not eating, the list went on and on. And so I did that, and Ellie continued to react. And now she was losing weight because I was also struggling to produce. And so the doctor said we needed to go on some formulas. And so we started down that journey. In the meantime, Ellie started having unknown triggered anaphylaxis. Her throat would close up. We would rush to the hospital. We would give EpiPens. We would stay in PICU. We would stay in general peds. We would be hospitalized for days and days and days. And we started down this journey of formulas. Nothing worked. She kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And so we ended up on an amino acid-based formula. At the time, my husband was working for a company that was self-insured and not regulated by Commerce. And the formula was not covered at all. It was $600 a month to keep her alive. She couldn't eat anything by food because we weren't sure why. She was constantly going into anaphylaxis. And our insurance at the time was self-insured, so wasn't required to follow any requirements and would not cover her formula. So I started working full-time at a group home in addition to my full-time job at a nonprofit. So I was working 35 hours a week doing sleep overnights at a group home and 40 hours plus a week as a program manager at a local nonprofit to have access to the health insurance, which was commercially regulated because it was a commercial product regulated by Commerce. And I did that so we could afford her formula. For this committee's reference, I worked 35 hours a week and I took home $250 every 2 weeks because the family premiums were so high, but that's beyond the point. And so I did all of this so that she could have access to the amino-based acid formula to keep her on the planet. And I went, her doctor sent in the prescription, and I went to the pharmacy and they said, I'm sorry, it's been denied. It'll be $650 at that point. And I had a complete and total breakdown in the middle of Hy-Vee because we were drowning in medical debt from all of the hospital visits and the switching insurance and the new deductibles and the new out-of-pockets and all of the things. And I didn't have $650. I had missed a ton of work. My husband had missed a ton of work. I had taken maternity leave, and we had another child with autism at home who had had a lot of medical expenses as well. And I didn't have $650. But I knew it was supposed to be covered because there was an agreement that it was supposed to be covered. The insurance companies had an agreement, but it wasn't covered. 6 months later, with work with Commerce and a lot of appeals and advocacy, it finally was covered. In that time, my daughter continued to be hospitalized. In that time, my husband and I continued to pull ourselves out of a very deep financial hole related to medical expenses. And in that time, I questioned whether I would be able to feed my child. This is already covered under CGIP. It's already covered under medical assistance. And there's an agreement with the commercial insurance companies that they will cover it. But it's not a full scope, and it's not in statute and law. My goal today is to make sure that no other family spends 6 months trying to figure out if they can feed their child because it's not in law
and it's in an agreement that you have to have the ability to know how to advocate and get covered.
Representative Hicks, thank you for the story and your experience, sharing your experience. I don't know that you need a testifier. You're your own testifier. That experience speaks volumes. So thank you for being here and your work on the bill. I want to just ask if there's anyone from the public that would wish to speak on this bill. Seeing none, I will move to members. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I'm just wondering, in your testimony, you mentioned that there are agreements in place, and this is already covered under CGIP and MA, but you said not the full scope. And so I'm wondering what this will expand.
Yeah. Representative Hicks.
Oh, thank you, Chair. The agreement is a signed agreement with some of the major commercial payers. But it doesn't encompass everyone. And like I said in my testimony, you have to be able to find the agreement, and you have to be able to get to the Commerce Department, and you have to be able to get through that process, which when you are in when you are in that kind of medical traumatic situation is really difficult. The only reason I was able to navigate it is because, frankly, I'm persistent and sort of obnoxious and really like statute and rule. Most people, when they go to the pharmacy and it's denied, just give up. And we don't need to rely on agreements. We're legislators, and we can put things in law to ensure that all families have the coverage they need.
Representative New Brindley, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like a good bulldog, so good for you. When you say it doesn't apply to everyone, do you mean that as part of the agreement it does not apply to everyone? Or it's just difficult to access for everyone?
So for sure the access. I'll be honest with you, the agreement was signed 10 years ago and the insurance market has shifted and changed. So there are new players in the market, you know, because we didn't used to allow as many folks. I'm happy to find a copy of the agreement and send it to you. I actually have it stored because I needed it. If I ever needed it, I needed to be able to pull it out in an argument. But I think good legislation and good policy doesn't rely on an agreement and the right insurance providers signing it. Good legislation, good policy, and equal access to health care is done by good legislators who put things in law.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Rep. New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks, and I agree with you completely. As legislators, we get to make the law. Sometimes we lose sight of that and say, well, the law says this. That's literally what we do here. So I do appreciate that. My last question is, has this been through benefit review, and is there a fiscal note yet?
There is no fiscal. Oh, Chair, I'm so sorry. There is no fiscal note because it's already covered under the state plans. It was submitted for benefit review, and my understanding is that there were no concerns because of the agreement.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Looks like you have another last question, Representative Brady.
Well, a follow-up on that. Does that mean that they wouldn't provide a benefit review? Is that allowed?
My understanding is that there were a lot of benefit reviews submitted in interim, but I can follow up with Commerce.
Commerce is coming to the table. If you would introduce yourself to the committee, please, and proceed.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, excuse me.
All right, habit.
In this committee, very much so. Representative New Brindley, we are working on the 62J review at present. It was requested, and it is in progress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Equity.
Mr. Chair, I would also note that we also have submitted a preliminary fiscal note through the fiscal note system as well, too. So,
Thank you. Thank you. Final word. More questions have come on. It's good to have help up here at the front. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just quickly did a search. I mean, our Minnesota providers provide this. It's already covered. I just looked up Medicas. I just looked up Health Partners. I'll keep looking them up. I mean, it takes like two minutes to find it. There's, and I'm wondering if it's already being offered, if it is already being offered, and we can identify whether or not it's being offered or not to the level that you want, and some of the products that are in here are listed only for ages 6 and down, some are for 6 and up. But if it's already being offered, and I'm assuming that there's going to be different levels of plans for people that buy in either a bronze plan or a silver plan or a gold plan, and maybe those things go along with that, and I know that you're talking about public programs, but why should we put something in statute that we're already, for the most part, and maybe we're not there far enough yet, but it's already there and it's being covered?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I will answer your question, but I did want to say the fiscal note does have zero on it. And so I'm actually not talking about our public plans. I'm talking about our commercial plans. And there should not be benefits based on age or based on feeding type, which is the other thing that comes into play a lot of times, is how people are getting the food. So Ellie, specifically, ate elemental formula as her primary source of nutrition until she was four. Four. Because she was allergic to everything under the sun. We used to joke that she was allergic to air. Ellie actually she is allergic. She has IE allergies. But what she has is a rare condition called mast cell activation syndrome. And we cannot and should not allow insurance companies to decide if someone's medical condition is the right one to get the food they need to stay on the planet. And it doesn't matter if you're 1 or 40 or 80. If you need amino acid-based formula to stay alive and you have commercial insurance, it should be covered. You shouldn't have to get onto taxpayer medical assistance to stay on the planet. You shouldn't have to be certified disabled just if the only thing you need is amino acid-based formula. We shouldn't force people through that pathway and put that money onto taxpayers in Minnesota when it can and should be covered by commercial insurance. It is a medical condition. It is a prescription necessary for life, and it should be treated as such, regardless of age or how it is consumed. And for people who have never experienced knowing that if you can't get this covered, your child will starve to death, it probably seems irrelevant and maybe not as necessary. But there was no other option for food. Everything she put in her mouth made her throat close, and she went into anaphylaxis. People deserve to have coverage that meets their medical needs. It should not be arbitrarily decided by age or format or any of that. It should be required. And I believe this bill does that. It has no fiscal impact to the state, and it ensures that families who are paying for commercial insurance can get access to the formula they need to stay alive.
No. Follow up?
No. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hicks, thank you so much for coming in. And a lot of what you just said with your personal experience is what I wanted to highlight. Today in this committee, we're hearing four different bills where people are coming to our committee and to the legislature asking for coverage for something that they find very difficult to have covered in the state of Minnesota. And I think it is worth stating outright the state of our insurance industry, our healthcare industry, where Minnesotans are coming and often in very difficult moments of their lives, finding out a child has a hyperallergenic or something else, or they lose a limb or something along these lines, and they find their insurance providers putting up barriers rather than helping. And it is worth stating again and again that this is not how it has to be. We're going to do better as we lay these over and hopefully include these in larger bills. But I think also we need to say that these are small fixes to a system that needs to change, and that we need to continue to listen to these voices and stories like Rep. Hicks with you and your daughter, that we can and should do better.
Thank you, Representative Chair. Smith. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Hicks for bringing this bill forward. I had a daughter. My second daughter was born a preemie. It's hard to look at you while I speak. Yes, my apologies. She was born a preemie, and the day we were discharged from the hospital, she had blood in her stool, and I had to bring her back.
And over again, I knew that there was something around her digestive system and something with my nursing her and just all of the ways in which, and I never, and as persistent as I am and as educated and as little barriers that I had regarding income and time and resources, I never got to the place where I could get her the things that she needed that would be covered by insurance, that everything that I explored, I had to pay out of pocket, and I didn't even know how to advocate because I'm somebody who is new to this country, even though I'd been here for 30 years when I had her, that I didn't have somebody before me navigating systems who could help me navigate. I was really doing it on my own. And so I really appreciate you bringing this forward because agreements between people don't always have to be honored. Agreements between, you know, why something should be covered, people always find reasons why they shouldn't cover you. And so I think that this is such a critical bill in order to put this into statute so that people are required, organizations and institutions are required to do the work that they need to ensure that, like I was taking trips to the emergency room every 3 days with my daughter because of the issues of what we were feeding her. And we eventually found our way to formulas that met her needs, but we continued to have to bring her to the hospital frequently, in emergency rooms in the middle of the night frequently. And so I just really appreciate you bringing this bill forward and ensuring that all families and their children's needs are met.
Thank you, Representative Herr. We have one more question, and then we'll go to final word from Representative Hicks. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a problem with, you know, helping out where we can help out. But to, you know, to the point about cost, it is real. It's called premiums for your insurance. I paid $3,000 a month and a $10,000 deductible because that was our best cost. It's what we had to do. So there is a true cost to the at the end of the day for insurance, and that will be passed on. So even though it doesn't show up on our state side and the fiscal note, it does show up to consumers. And that's what mandates do, is they raise the cost of insurance. That raises the cost of care for families. So that's the only point I'd like to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Final word, Representative Hicks.
Yes. Thank you, committee, for hearing this. And I just want to say, if you're paying, I was working 35 hours a week at a group home, and my paychecks were $250 every 2 weeks because it was all going to our premiums. If you're paying for insurance, it should cover the things you need to stay on the planet. Mandates are not about trying to raise costs. Mandates are about making sure that the coverage that people are paying for out of their paychecks and that their employers are paying for do what they need to do to make sure that the people paying those premiums get what they need. Because when they don't, it's not cost neutral. People don't just let their children starve. They get them certified disabled, and they put them on medical assistance, and the taxpayers in Minnesota pay for it too. You can't undo required care. If people need it, they need it. And it doesn't go away just because we didn't ask them to pay for it. We just divert the cost somewhere else. It is important to ensure that when consumers are paying for a product, they are getting the coverage they need from that product. And this mandate is one step in that direction.
Thank you, Representative Hicks, for the bill. And House File 3889 is laid over for possible inclusion. All right, we will move on to House File 4557. Representative Cleavorn will take the head there. And Chair moves House File 4557, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Cleavorn, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much, and I would like to thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the consideration of House File 4557 today, which has to do with scalp hair prosthesis. Oftentimes we refer to them as wigs, but it could be other accessories that are medically necessary. The bill itself is very short. It's two paragraphs, but what it does is it restores the dignity for all individuals who have suffered hair loss due to medical treatment. And that's why I'm here today to ask for this mandate. The potential, so what this bill will do is expand an existing private sector health insurance mandate requiring coverage for scalp hair prosthesis in the case of hair loss due to a medical necessary treatment. and it would include all equipment and accessories necessary for regular use of scalp hair prosthesis worn for hair. The coverage required by this section is subject to a copayment, coinsurance, deductible, and other enrollee cost-sharing requirements that apply to similar types of items under the policy plan, certificate, or contract. And that is the basis of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I don't see any testifiers, but is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to the bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member questions and discussion. Representative Acorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleavorn, for bringing forward this bill. And I am a breast cancer survivor and spent 6 months enduring chemotherapy that caused me to lose my hair. And I will say there were days when I wanted to just go out in public and not be looked at as a cancer patient and somebody just doing the little head tilt and all. And all good intentions, but sometimes you just want to fly under the radar. You just want to go and get your groceries or go and do what you have to do. And so I did have a wig, and it allowed me to do that. It allowed me to live my life publicly, less as a cancer patient. It's hard to be looked at in that way 24/7 every day of the week. So I think that this is just a really important benefit. I'm not going to call it a mandate. I'm going to call it a benefit that that patients deserve when they're going through probably one of the hardest things of their life. And so I very much appreciate you bringing it forward, and I strongly support. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Acum. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, Representative Cleaver, I'm like, wait, who is
this? It's me.
Proposing this bill right now? My question is, this bill has changed pretty significantly from when the mandate review process was done, especially that it has really expanded. It initially... The underlying language only applied to alopecia, and then the original language would have added a cancer. Now it's to any health condition. That's a significant expansion. And the original language had a cap. It had a $1,000 cap, and now there's no cap. So public health programs already cover this. Do they cover it with no cap and for any condition, or should this now generate a fiscal note? And perhaps maybe even nonpartisan staff would know that.
Reborn.
Yes, thank you. And I probably should have put in your packets the email that I received from Commerce, which I didn't. But so recently, CMS has issued additional guidance in its 2023 Notice of Benefit and Payment Parameters, which is called the NBPP, which is the requirement that says there are non-discrimination requirements to the EBS. And it states that benefit designs that restrict coverage on the basis of health condition are presumptively discriminatory under CFR section 156.125 when applied to EHB services where there is no clinical basis for the limitation. So what we're doing with this bill, in the original bill, and as you've stated, currently alopecia areata is the only, if we leave it like that, it would be considered discriminatory. And by opening this, because there's no clinical basis. And so by opening this up, we are complying with federal law, they went on to say that when we are state frail of health plan costs are not required when states update their laws to align with federal requirements, which is why you don't have a fiscal note. So it's a lot to say we're trying to conform with federal law.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. And Mr. Brickwitty has joined us again. If you have a comment on that.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, couldn't have said it better myself. Happy to answer questions if there are some from members.
Very good. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it seems that that's exactly why we should have a fiscal note, because it is then a pretty significant expansion of current
law and coverage. So we certainly should have a fiscal note because we're going to have to account for that.
If this gets
passed through into an omnibus bill, that's going to have to be accounted for in the targets.
Mr. Brickwood. Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, there was a fiscal note on the bill as introduced because at the time, and this is reflected in our 62J report on this proposal, the Commerce Department's assumption was that the bill as introduced would necessitate defrayal, which is what generates a fiscal note. Subsequent to our 62J review being done, the NBPP was issued and the additional federal guidance that Representative Cleburne spoke to was issued, clarifying that the federal government, who is in charge of the rules for defrayal requirements, has updated its guidance on non-discrimination requirements. Mm-hmm. And so as Representative Cleburne walked through, they have changed their presumption about what would or would not be discriminatory in this context. And so that's why, as with the bill as amended, the fiscal note has been reduced to zero, because in a clarification scenario of an existing benefit that's already on the books to prevent it from being presumptively discriminatory, the state is not responsible for defraying health plans' costs associated with such a change. And so therefore, we would not have a fiscal note that would need to be accounted for.
Thank you, Mr. Recruiting. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that explanation. And that makes total sense that from a commerce perspective, we are not on the hook for defrayal. However, my question is, this should likely generate a fiscal note from MMB for CGIP coverage and from DHS for public program coverage, because it is likely expanding those programs. And so while I understand that this is bringing it in line with CMS, we still have to account for those costs. And so it should have a fiscal note reflecting what those costs will be to MMB and DHS. And I don't know if there's anyone here from either of those departments.
Mr. Harney has some input.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, just to provide clarity here, there is an active fiscal note request. The Department of Commerce is the only state entity to respond to that preliminary request at this point. The Department of Management and Budget, DHS, are all on the request. They just simply haven't submitted their responses.
Thank you, Mr. Harney.
Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are about 10 different reasons why a person can lose their hair. And during the pandemic, there was kind of an epidemic of a condition called telogen effluvium, in which people lose their hair maybe for no other reason than just severe stress. And someone who's very dear to me experienced that condition during the pandemic. And so I think that's, you know, a reason why they were generalizing the language. Was just not one or two conditions, because there are lots of reasons why someone might lose their hair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We'll go to Representative Quam and then final word. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we probably could have saved 10 minutes if nonpartisan staff would have informed us of that clarification that you know, there are other groups there. You know, whenever we have a question about a fiscal note and one entity is not going to, you know, comes up and says that they aren't, please let us know quickly that there are still fiscal notes in process. Because part of the problem we have is we don't see a lot of materials. As the author mentioned, there was some note from an entity about XYZ. You know, without information, it's hard for us to decide. And fiscal notes, because some of us are actually concerned about the statutory imbalance that's coming up. And if we could get, you know, actually that up front more quickly, I think that would help us a lot with addressing stuff. Because I hope you understand. I was around through several multi-billion dollar deficit budget periods, and it is not fun. And the sooner you understand situations, the better. So I'm just asking for a quicker heads up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Final word, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, members. And I would just like to say that research has shown that losing your hair during chemotherapy or radiation therapy, or for a whole host of reasons that cause people to lose their hair, can have a severe and negative impact on one's life. And the psychological impacts range from loss of self-esteem, anxiety, depression, and it is time burden trying to figure out how to conceal it. This is one simple piece of legislation that we can pass that would certainly help people restore their dignity in a time of great crisis in their own personal life. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward, Representative Cleburne. And the bill is laid over, House File 4557, for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda, House File 3330. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager will come forward. And would you like to move your bill, House File 3330, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus?
Yes, please.
All right, so moved. We will have you present the bill, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just want to say thank you to everyone, testifiers, members who have shared deeply impacting stories. This bill is another one that I, with deep, heartfelt gratitude, am here to present today. So I'd like to kind of paint a picture. Imagine you have a child, a grandchild, a niece, or a nephew, and they've been hospitalized for some genetic disorder. We don't know what it is, but something's wrong. It can take seven or more specialists over 5 years, usually with multiple misdiagnoses, just to get an answer. How many hospitalizations, how many attempted treatments have also occurred, adding to this cost as you're trying to find an answer? Now imagine how different things could be if your insurance covered rapid whole genome sequencing. You would have an answer within 2 weeks. I've seen some companies do it as low as 3 days. You would have quicker access to treatments, quicker access to interventions. You would get answers sooner. And think of just a hospitalization stay alone, 2 weeks versus 6 months, the thousands of dollars you would save. Think of the long-term health savings that you're going to have because you're going to have an effective treatment, an effective intervention right away instead of 5-7 years down the road. So that's what House File 3330 is about, is making sure that rapid whole genome sequencing is covered by private insurance. We already have it available in public programs. It's intentionally narrow to make sure that we are providing the help to our most vulnerable kids and babies. Based on the technology alone, the guardrails are already intact. If you do a whole genome sequence of somebody, there is no additional information that doing it a second time would give you because you already have the entire genomic sequence there. This is something that providers already have in their toolbox to be able to provide for their patients. According to the benefit report from Commerce, 2 pennies a month, which is incredible to me. I would also like to give a special thanks to Representative Torkelson for his conversations throughout this bill process, and I am very humbled and grateful that it is also bipartisan. And I think with that, I will leave it up to my testifier and questions.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. You have a testifier, Dr. Barry.
Didn't you make it?
Welcome, Dr. Barry. If you could please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, gotta get my glasses on. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about rapid genome sequencing as a medical tool, as encompassed in Health File 3330. So, by way of introduction, I'm Dr. Susan Barry. I'm a pediatrician and medical geneticist at the University of Minnesota, where I'm a professor in the Division of Genetics and Metabolism. I'm also the director of our Rare Disease Center of Excellence. The university and mHealth Fairview were invited to seek this designation by the National Organization for Rare Disorders. So we are in a position to assist in facilitating some of the diagnostic needs for the diagnostic odyssey that was described by the representative. We and our rare disease colleagues at the Mayo Clinic service centers to improve that diagnostic and treatment process for persons with rare diseases. And among our most challenging and vulnerable recipients of that are critically ill newborns, often with genetic disorders. So making a rapid diagnosis in a critically ill newborn is difficult. There's a lot going on then. And while occasionally observation of the symptoms is sufficient for a tentative diagnosis, further testing is frequently necessary and essential to our planning for appropriate medical management. With the advent of these new technologies such as rapid genome sequencing, our ability to make a meaningful medical diagnosis is considerably and quite markedly improved. Before these test procedures were available, we made decisions solely on based solely on what we saw in front of us. But with the advent of this diagnosis, we're in a much better position to significantly shorten that diagnostic odyssey for a family, particularly at a critical time in their child's life. Now, speaking as a clinician who's used these modalities, the decision to do a genome sequence is not undertaken lightly. We offer this on an inpatient basis, primarily in those settings where an established diagnosis is going to make a difference in medical management of the child. We don't just do it to do it. Knowledge itself is an important element. Knowing answers is really important, but particularly for a critical neonate, medical management is the key to justifying doing these kinds of procedures and seeking this information. At this point, in most cases, when this type of testing is ordered in the hospital, the cost for the procedure is simply eaten by the hospital. They just suck it up and eat it. They're willing to do this because it's the right thing to do, but it's a relatively expensive procedure, should be compensated, should be accounted for in what we do. Ultimately, an accurate diagnosis, even obtained using a complex test, will save resources. More importantly, it's the right thing to do for families who are seeking knowledge about making loving and thoughtful decisions for their children. Ultimately, we save costs and, more importantly, give critical information to families. I'd like to urge your consideration for making sure that no family is in a position where they can't obtain essential medical answers that will help them decide, along with their care providers, what are the right medical decisions for their baby. So I'm happy to answer any questions about this. It's kind of technical issue, whole genome sequencing. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. And if you want to just sit tight there for if there are questions, since there are no other testifiers that I see. Although, I just want to ask if there's anybody else in the public that would like to speak on this. Ms. Barnes? Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Vice Chair. And I'm sorry, I thought I notified the committee that I wanted to testify, so I apologize if that was an oversight.
No, no problem.
So,
thank you.
Thank you. So, Vice Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3330. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. The Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council is a state agency whose mission is to improve care for the 1 in 10 Minnesotans living with a rare disease. One of our pillars of focus is reducing time to diagnosis due to the fact that diagnostic delay is a salient feature of the rare disease community, as Dr. Berry has stated. There are over 7,000 rare diseases, the vast majority of which are genetic and medically complex. Even if some of these rare diseases could theoretically be diagnosed symptomatically, the low prevalence, sheer volume, and extreme complexity of these diseases makes diagnosing them through traditional methods incredibly challenging. Fortunately for our community, the field of medical genetics and genetic testing has advanced exponentially in recent years. In 2022, the Rare Disease Advisory Council Cost Work Group, in collaboration with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, a PhD student, completed a cost-effectiveness analysis on the use of whole genome sequencing in the Minnesota Medicaid population. The analysis compared the costs and outcomes for three different strategies. Number one, standard diagnostic care with no whole genome sequencing. Number two, first-line whole genome sequencing. And number three, standard diagnostic care followed by whole genome sequencing. The analysis's results indicated that first-line whole genome sequencing yielded the highest percentage of infant diagnosis at 57%, highest percentage of infants with changes to their clinical management, so 31%, shortest diagnostic duration, 2 weeks, and the shortest expected length of stay in the NICU, 52 days. In addition, the reduction in the NICU stay made first-line whole genome sequencing cost-effective. Based on these findings, the workgroup then developed inclusion criteria to ensure that genetic testing would be applied to the appropriate patient population. This criteria was subsequently adopted by DHS in the Medicaid fee-for-service pediatric population. While we applaud the expansion of rapid whole genome sequencing in fee-for-service, we believe that this legislation is necessary to ensure that coverage is adopted by commercial payers as well. The Council believes that coverage for rapid whole genome sequencing for all children suspected of having a rare disease is both the right thing to do and makes economic sense. So we urge you to pass House File 3330. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And stay by for questions in case that those come up as well.
Sure.
Let's see. Would anybody else? We have one more call for the public, if there's anybody else. And if not, we'll move to discussion among members. I do have one question for you, Ms. Barnes. Rare diseases and the length of time it takes to get a diagnosis, I know that that's quite long. I mean, I'm thinking 7-10 years in some cases. And with something of this nature, this whole genome, that could take care of that and move that up to a year or two or less even, or automatically. So just wondered about, you know, any comments you have on how dramatic of a change this would be for diagnosing rare diseases.
Yeah, genetic testing has transformed the ability to get diagnosis for the rare disease community. It's estimated about 80% of all rare diseases are genetic, have genetic etiology. So, and that number isn't, you know, there's no hard data, but the estimation is about 80% of all rare diseases are genetic. So the ability to use these testing to get a definitive diagnosis has been very transformative for the rare disease community.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Member questions, we'll start with Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And approximately what is the current cost for the whole genome test?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, or if Dr. Berry, perhaps?
I have my online search, but I'll look.
Yeah, I looked this up yesterday because it varies, because it's changed. Different labs mm-hmm. charge different amounts. A sort of order of magnitude, if that helps you, is $1,000 to $2,000. Now, by frame of reference, for example, a head MRI can be $4,000 to $6,000 to $10,000, depending on how it's performed and what it does.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Representative Quam, follow-up?
That's, I think, some years ago, I was working with like a 3K. What is is there the possibility of doing a, you know, one ohm does a panel of a couple dozen, I think they're approaching three dozen. Is there a look at doing a panel that would be aimed at the, these rare genetic diseases? And I think that has a quicker, response.
Shall I,
Dr. Berry?
Respond? Okay, so you can do panels. Panels, the larger the panel gets, the more ambiguous it gets. When you do an exome or genome, the sort of larger scale tests, typically do them as a trio with the parents. When you do panels, you get a lot of ambiguous information. You may get an answer, but you also may get changes in the genetic material that are the bane of my personal existence, are what we call variants of uncertain significance. The more you do in a panel without parental information, the more ambiguous it gets. So an exome or a genome is a way to, and in the end, the panels cost not that much different than an exome at this point. We are staying away from larger panels because they give too much ambiguity.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Representative Quam.
Thank you. And actually, several years ago, the one ohm set of panels for the pharmacogenomic was at around 28 different tests, mm-hmm. and it was at about $300. And I understand some of the differences because, over a decade ago, I had a discussion with the Mayo researcher that was part of mm-hmm. the genome team that did the initial work. In fact, one of them spun off from some Mayo research. So I'm trying to understand, the disease-causing genetic change, I've always looked at it as mutations.
The technical term that we typically apply these days is variant, because okay. we don't want people to think they have alien blood or something like that. The mutation is a technical term that's correct. It's typically referred to as variants.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Representative Quam, follow up?
Right. No, I'm glad that you confirmed, because one of the things I was looking at is the parental pass on, and if there was a, I guess a screen to do that. What is, frankly, I don't see an issue with, people say cost. Well, if you've got a rare disease or you've got some complicated situation, the diagnostics to try and find out are going to far exceed this cost, and the lead time causes, additional medical or complication issues. I'm a little bit confused by the 21 years of age, because some of the things don't trigger by the age of 21. There are some rare diseases and conditions that happen in the 20s or, mid-20s and beyond. So why was 21 selected?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yes, good question. I'll be honest, my personal opinion, I would love this to be available to anybody in an outpatient kind of setting. But we wanted to really focus on our most vulnerable, the more pediatric age for this particular bill.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Quam, we have four more people on the mm-hmm. list.
I can go offline for more detailed stuff. This is just general.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. One of the most complicating factors in healthcare is that diagnosis and treatment. That's the most complex and difficult process to do. And there's a couple of really promising practices that are coming forward. That would include genomic sequencing, pharmacogenetics, which Representative Quam referred to already, in which they can identify certain types of cancer and the most effective treatments. Because I think the process most of the time in trying to diagnose and treat is sort of throwing things at the wall, right? Seeing what works, what doesn't work. We spend a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of inefficiency in that process. And I wonder if you could, you mentioned that the hospitals were willing to absorb this cost because the return on investment was significant, right, in being able to treat patients more quickly, more effectively, to diagnose. Could you speak a little bit to what a typical practice looks like when you don't have genomic sequencing, and sort of what those timelines and what that methodology looks like, that throwing things at the wall, that could kind of help us put in perspective yeah. why this is such a big return on investment.
Dr. Berry.
I can't tell you how my practice has changed more radically during the more than 40 years that I've been doing medical genetics than the advent of testing like genomic and exome sequencing. I'm seeing patients back that I tried to diagnose 25, 30, 40 years ago who are now coming in, and I can give them a diagnosis. I can tell them why they've been living with what they've been living with. You talk about testimony. I saw a young woman that I saw when she was maybe 3 or 4. I saw her again when she was 10. I tell them to come back because I don't know what the answer is, but someday we will. And lo and behold, she came back. She and her new husband, they were going to try and have a baby. She said, I know I've got something genetic. I don't know what it is. and we did an exome and genome closely related test, and lo and behold, we found it. We know exactly what's wrong with her. We know what her risks are. We know what some future problems might be for her. We can change her health even now. That's why I don't like the 21 thing either, but you can do what you need to do, because Medicare won't pay for genetic testing.
Thank you.
So just saying.
Thank you,
but that's too much.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Follow-up, Representative Bonner?
No, thank you. That was, I guess, exactly what I was trying to get at, is that I think we are in a really incredible place in time in which we have really promising practices and technologies that are accelerating our ability to not only diagnose, but to be more effective in the treatments, to save money, to save time, to be able to actually meet people where they literally are, and find better pathways for them to live stronger, healthier lives. And this is one of those types of bills that I think just makes sense, whether it's we're talking about the economics or the actual health of individuals. It just makes sense. So thank you for bringing it forward, and I appreciate you indulging me.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Berry, for being here. I've really appreciated learning about genome sequencing from you, or somewhat. Can you tell me, or maybe it's...
Don't get me started.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm not going to sign up for your classes. I'm sorry. Can we talk about access for this? How many labs across the state do this? Are they connected to hospitals? Are they outside clinics? Are they private practicing groups? I may have a question on reimbursement once I get the answer to that.
Well, so the labs are available. There are lots of labs that do this test. In our current setting, we like to send the test in-house because it costs less to do it in the hospital. We are very lucky at the University of Minnesota. We have a genome center where we can do genome testing. That is not a standard available lab in many places. The Mayo people do a lot of genetic sequencing. The other thing that happens relatively frequently is there are outside labs whose job it is to do this. I have my favorites because they give good reports and good interpretation. Not anybody should do this test because it's not the test itself that's difficult. It's the interpretation. And if you don't have good data to do an interpretation, you will not get a good answer. So we are very picky about which labs we send it to. We love our in-house lab. We can't always get insurance to pay for it. And so sometimes we have other labs that have more accessible insurance strategies for outpatient purposes, for example.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau, follow-up?
Yeah, so quickly. So just talk about access across the state. Somebody in Brainerd, for example, International Falls, Duluth, do they have to travel for this? Is this something gets sent? Is there labs in those facilities?
So this lab should really only be sent and performed by people who know how to interpret the information. A family practitioner in Brainerd might have the best of intentions, but if they send an exome and they get back 27 variants of uncertain significance, they're not going to know what to do with it. So this is a very specialized set of laboratory tests. In terms of access, we have a number of strategies. We can use telemedicine. We can use virtual appointments for initiating care. But it really needs to be done with expert interpretation available. That's the key element in making a good use of this rare test.
Comment, Representative Hemingson-Yeager.
Yeah, I just want to add that anytime you're getting into like genetic disorders, usually your provider, your family physician is going to be working with a team, and you're going to be working with a clinical geneticist, a genetic counselor, to go through exactly those things to tease apart the details of what does this amazing data mean.
Thank you. Representative Doe.
Yeah, and so my final thing then is if this is the interpretation is important, where the labs are is important, the team approach I totally get. So are we appropriately addressing that in this bill where we're forcing insurance companies to either increase their capitation rates for hospital or, you know, providing this coverage if, for example, there's only one or two or 10 people that actually can properly interpret this? Is this the best method to ensure adequate and proper access for those incredibly important services, because I think we all want that. But is this the right mechanism to force that mandate on insurance companies that may or may not have providers with that level of expertise in their networks?
And who would like to take that one? Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
I would say yes, this is an excellent mechanism. I mean, for all the reasons we described, I think it would be more harmful to the family in greater Minnesota to not have access to this test and to sit and wonder and travel around the state, travel around the country. I have a friend who I went to grad school in Iowa. She had to go multiple trips to Boston just to get an answer for her son. And, you know, with advents like telehealth, you know, I would hope that in networks, people are creative and providers can say, look, I can order this test. We can do this test. I used to work in a clinical lab doing whole genome analysis. It was a blood test that we did. That they can utilize telehealth to maybe get in contact with a genetic counselor, because genetic counselors may not be in every clinic in the state. But I think we need this test so that people can have the answers, and they can have the answers right away, so that they're not traveling around the state searching for that provider, driving to Mayo Clinic because it's the one specialty doctor that knows this type of disease. So I would say, yes, this is an excellent mechanism.
Ms. Barnes would like to weigh in.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Bierman, and I believe that the bill specifies that these are children admitted to a NICU, correct? And I will make a comment, and then if Representative Hemmingson-Yeager wants to back me up or provide extra information, I believe that not all children's hospitals in the state of Minnesota have a NICU, and so those hospitals that do have these NICUs would have the resources and the expertise to do the type of analysis that they would need to do. I know that those aren't widespread, so I don't know if you have additional information to add to that, but given the fact that it's already sort of confined to children's hospitals with NICUs, I think you're kind of helping get your expertise concentrated.
Thank you for that additional information. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been privileged to be on the Rare Disease Council since I've been here, and I've learned a lot about rare disease. You know, the comment of seeing 7+, you know, providers to get your diagnosis is real, and some people never have gotten their diagnosis. And so this, I believe, is a real opportunity for us to save cost, because it's all about knowing the information and knowing it soon enough that makes the big difference here. The solutions for rare disease are really going to be, there's going to be a lot of them coming up. And this is a really important bill, because I think it shows that we can sharply improve this, but this is the best way that we know we can do it. And I think at the end of the day, will actually save us money long term. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, and for your service on the council. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. We have obviously talked about this offline, and you know, in addition, Representative Murphy, does saving costs. More importantly, I think it'll save lives. You know, I had a little boy in my office a couple of weeks ago who got a diagnosis too late, and so he will never walk, he will never breathe on his own, et cetera. However, there's a little girl with his same condition who was diagnosed through genetic testing significantly earlier, and she is doing all of those things. So that is really the bottom line of this mandate. Now, I will say that I'm very frustrated, because there's a pattern here today that a bill is submitted for mandate review, it is submitted for fiscal notes, but that is not the bill we're hearing now. And I'm really frustrated that these bills are changing in significant ways. This bill now explicitly applies to public programs, which it didn't do in the beginning. Now, I understand that it's covered under fee-for-service already, but this is going to expand that. So I'm going to assume that there is an active fiscal note in progress. Can I just get a head nod? Or there is an active fiscal note in progress, because, again, I should clarify that. As amended, the fiscal note is Perfect. I'm getting a head nod that, yes, there's an active fiscal note for the bill as amended. But I am super frustrated with the fact that most of these bills, well, some of them haven't even gone through mandate review, which is wild that we're even hearing bills that don't go through the mandate review process. But those that have gone through mandate review have changed. They're not the same bill anymore. That's incredibly frustrating. I look forward to seeing the fiscal note and what this will do, because this particularly, of all the bills we have heard and all of these mandates that we've heard, I think this one actually saves lives in a different way. It has also been through the appropriate channels and the appropriate process. But it's been changed significantly since then. So I hope we can learn from that and maybe do things a bit better and more properly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yeah. Comment? So the amended fiscal review has been completed. I looked at it, and I believe, memory serves me right, about $47,000 for the cost, which was not too much different from the benefit review. The language was added basically in consultation with DHS, just to make sure that everything is falling in line there. And so this is all just making sure that, like, everything is nice and tight.
Thank you. Any final word, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Yeah, thank you. I think we've kind of really driven home that this is a very powerful tool. We've had advancements in medicine that are amazing, and we need to make sure that we're keeping up. That's actually what got me into this job, is to make sure that the policy is keeping up with the genetic technology. This will also lead to decreased healthcare costs down the line. If we can get those interventions and those treatments right away, we can save all that money later on. Not only will this deeply impact families, I'm just thinking about, like, the stress of being in a NICU and wondering what's going on over months and years, but the ability to have an answer now and to be a family and to have a kid be a normal kid, I think is deeply impactful. And then, again, it impacts our healthcare system long term too. So I greatly appreciate your attention. Great conversation, discussion. And if anybody wants to nerd out with genetics with me later, I'd be lovely to have a conversation with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. And House File 3330 is laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we will have to hear House File 4853 at the next meeting, which will be Thursday, April 4th, 10:30 a.m. in this room. And with that, committee is adjourned. Thank you.